Hello and welcome to this episode of Better Off Red. My name's Pip Adam and this is episode 130. I'm recording this on my phone again. I keep leaving my recorder at work and you can probably hear my heat pump in the background, which I'm incredibly grateful. It's very cold today in Wellington, which is nice. It's meant to be winter. I'm always glad when it's cold. Anyway, you know, weather forecast aside, this is a recording of an event that I was lucky enough to do with Annalise Jochims at Bookhound, which is just, you know, one of my favourite people and one of my favourite places. So it was incredible. So this was recorded on Sunday the 23rd. It was a really, really foul day. Like, it was raining. It was that kind of just sheets of rain and it was freezing. And I'm just so grateful. You know, so many people came and we had such a nice time. It was just, yeah, some of my favorite people were there. And we had a great time. And it was fun. And this is the recording of that. I've known Annalise for a while now, and I think, you know, I really feel comfortable in her company, and I think you can kind of hear that in my, you know, sort of leaning into my awkwardness a little bit in this talk. But yeah, I'm really glad to send this to you. And I'm very appreciative, as always, that you have subscribed to the Substack. Well, anyway, thank you so much, and I hope you enjoy it. I am going to be giving away, I'm going to give away a copy of Audition. So, if you just want to hit me up before this time next week, so cash. But yeah, on Twitter, my DMs are open, and also you can get hold of me on Instagram as well. So yeah, there you go. Oh my gosh. Or you can leave a comment under the under the Substack. Thank you so much. And I will catch up with you soon. Thanks heaps.
I want to say a couple of things about it before we start, because I think some of you might not have read it. And I think it's one of those ones where everyone's going to have different opinions about it, so I kind of wanted to lay out where I'm coming from before I ask my questions. Okay, so firstly, we are committed to no spoilers, which I think is going to be challenging sometimes because there's not really a division between spoilers and conceptual developments in the book. It's kind of like the plot is the concept and the concept is the plot. So if we're awkward and weird, that's the reason, clearly. And I'll just tell you the premise. So Alba, Stanley, and Drew, the giants, are hurtling through space in a ship. Where they don't know. They don't know who they are either. But when the novel starts, they know for sure that they've grown and suspect they're still growing. They're packed in so tightly that both their bodies and the ship are in the process of breaking. But also, as the distance between them and planet Earth increases, they begin to remember who they are. Or do they? And so I wanted to highlight this phrase from Stanley. He says that the ships radiate out from all over the Earth's surface into endless space, a new astrology. So there's a real mystery about what is happening in this book and why it's happening and what's going on in human nature, where this could happen. But I think it could happen. It's also about prisons and incarceration. And I wanted to say at the centre of this densely metaphorical and allegorical novel is something real. This year there are about 8,300 and 78 people in prison, which is more than I would have guessed. And I think Pip has some thoughts about that, so we'll circle back to that later on. And I also wanted to say that the book is structured like a prism. With each section, there's a pivot, and we're oriented in a different way, we're positioned differently, and we have a new perspective on who we were before when we were reading previous sections. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I think, everything I wanted to say before starting. Hi, Pip.
Hi.
Oh, hello.
Do you want to say hi?
Oh, hi, everyone. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, cheers.
Cool. Okay, so I read this amazing essay by Pip in ANZL, and I have some questions after reading that, and I think everyone should look it up because it's really fascinating and it really changed the way that I understood the book. And so one thing you said in there that I found really fascinating, you wrote, "I am not the kind of person who can slip into suspended disbelief, and it's not how I enjoy consuming culture. I find it hard to not see the machinery and at the same time as I am reading or watching. So I think this means I'm interested in the ways the artificiality of the work can draw attention to the artificiality of life." And I was thinking of this as a kind of practice of incredulity. And I was thinking of you and the world being incredulous. And I was wondering how that feels. And I was wondering, is that a choice or is that the way that you've always experienced things? And what does it mean for you?
Can you just define what incredulous means?
Oh, yeah. So I think I actually Googled it before writing this. Yeah. It means kind of not believing, not just believing everything.
Oh, yeah.
Just okay. Being like,
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds true. Oh, yeah. Thank you. Before I start, I just want to think about the land that we're on and also, like, just the people that have walked over this land, because it helps to steady me a little bit. So, and also the injustices that have happened here, and maybe just some of the work that people are doing to try and have guardianship over this land, and it's not an easy time to be doing it. And yeah, so I just want to think about that first. I'm very confused by a lot of things, and I think I've always been this way. Like, I can't remember... I just have always been very confused by things and people especially, and I think the way people organize themselves I find really confusing as well. So I think I don't know if it's a choice, but I definitely there are times when I need to kind of mask that misunderstanding to kind of get through life and go to work and those kind of things, but generally, it's something that I'm really grateful that I can lean more and more into. And that's largely because of the work of other people. You know, like, I think when I was little, there was kind of only one way of being. I'm real old. And when I was little, there was kind of only one way of being in the world. But I feel like people have been willing to talk about the way that they see the world a lot more. And, I just feel really grateful for that. And what it feels like often is quite sad. It makes me quite sad, like, sometimes, like, because I sort of think one of the things I really don't understand is power structures. Like, I don't understand why we pay CEOs more than people who collect rubbish, and, you know, just things like that. I'm very confused about why we don't just give people enough money to live comfortably. And I think that people explain things to me. People are really kind and they explain things to me, like economics and stuff, but I still don't really understand it. So I think a lot of my writing is trying to work out, and that extends to literature as well. I don't really understand literature. Like, I'm very confused by first person narrative. Like, I'm just like, where are they standing, and what are they doing when they're telling the story, and what's going on? And yeah, so I think that's why, I think that was like me showing off a bit, saying I'm not the tired person, but what I meant was I'm incapable of doing that. Like, yeah, so that's what I've got to say about that. Sorry, did I talk too much? Anyway.
No, when I read that quote, I was like, oh, I am the kind of person who can be very credulous.
Oh.
There are upsides and downsides to that as well. But reading your book, and after reading your book, and between sessions of reading your book, just walking around, I felt very incredulous. It's like a window. It just makes everything so strange. And it's so... Another side of this is that your book is very funny. And a lot of the times when I found it funny, I was like, is this bit funny? Am I right that this is funny? And so another phrase you used in your essay, you said costumes of realism. And it kind of made me think of like the, you know, that kid's story where the king is like the emperor's new clothing and he's actually the nude. Your book kind of reminded me of that. And I wondered about this incredulity and humour. And also, I'm giving you a lot here, but your book is kind of like a mystery story. Like, what the hell is going on? And the world became a mystery for me after reading it. I was like, what is going on? Yeah, do you have anything to say about any of those things? Principally, humour. Because it's a really funny book.
Okay, cheers. I'm often wondering what is going on. And I think that one of the things... I don't think writing can do much. I think that art is nice, and I think that it can form some kind of community. But I think that we still need to be active in other ways. Like, I think activism, I don't think just my writing can be the activism that I do, but the thing about it is that what I think writing is very successful doing, perhaps better than, but like, I think it's very good at making things seem strange, and that's always what I'm trying to do. Is like, I think that we walk around in our lives, I was reading something today about this idea about, this is a very old-fashioned idea, but this idea that we hold the fact that we're going to die, you know, that everything, we're going to die, we hold that at the same time as kind of getting up and making breakfast and doing these things to keep ourselves living. And I think, I feel that's very much how I feel about prisons as well. I remember being at a writers' festival in Auckland and everybody was quite congratulatory, and just like 5 minutes drive down the road, someone was involved in a hunger strike. And yeah, I think that any way that I can make the world and the way that we, the things that we take for granted, I want to make them unusual, because I think if they're unusual, and I think laughter can be political as well. I think, you know, like, if you're laughing at it, then you're not seeing it as a normal, you know, and I think there's some kind of surrender in laughing. Like, sometimes your body kind of just opens up in a way that maybe it doesn't when it's being serious. Also, I also have this very, I wouldn't really say this anywhere else, but like, I feel very embarrassed about being a writer. Like, my parents both work really hard and have always worked really hard, and they think it's, yeah, so I think that I can never take myself too seriously, if you know what I mean. Like, I think both of them think that writing's a bit weird. And I still, I mean, I'm really old, I'm like 52, but I still care about what they think and I still respect them. And yeah, so I think I could never write, you know, I really hear myself when I'm getting, my grandmother used to call it putting on ears. And yeah, I can really hear it when I do that. So I think that's why I'm there as well. That's what I think.
Yeah. This is not a question I came up with earlier, but I'm just wondering about this like, because I see you as someone who is quite self-disciplined in terms of not putting on airs. And I also see myself as, sometimes I just start talking to myself around the house and say really egotistical things. And I'm like, God, who am I? Is this related? Is this putting on airs? Is this related to just, yeah, are they part of the same thing for you? Is this, yeah? How do you work, Pip?
I think that there's an arrogance that comes with me pushing down that as well. You know, like, I think I'm really interested in the idea of being right sized, which I think is why the giants were interesting to me, I feel like I'm in a psychoanalysis. My relationship with my father. I think Yeah, I think that one of the worst things in our family would be to be arrogant, and I think that is sometimes I'm as arrogant about being humble as I am about being arrogant, if you know what I mean. Like, I'm a massive fisher for compliments, I think. You know, like, I'll often go, oh, it's terrible. You know, tell me how fantastic I am. So, yeah, I think it is, it's a pathology that I'm trying to, you know, I spent my whole life trying to fix it. And I think that with the writing, I think that it does come with a degree of kind of, like, forcing down as well, you know, like, and I think that that squeezes out, that judgment is kind of helpful in second and third drafts, but it's not so helpful while I'm writing. Yeah, that's right.
So you mentioned size, and that was something I really wanted to ask you about, because the people who get big, the people who start growing, I think it's possible to do a lot of speculation about how to define which people are likely to start growing and which people aren't. I'm going to try not to get into that, but they're probably people who haven't been listened to, and I think at some point it says that they're people who are accustomed to being told what to do. And so they find themselves in this position where they're really powerful and scary, and then somehow they end up on this ship, which they did not choose to be on. So they're maybe not powerful, very huge and powerful, in the middle of space, kind of powerless again. I don't know, could you talk about size a little bit?
Yeah, like, what I was interested in is physical power versus political power, and I realise that this runs me into all sorts of very fucking dodgy, you know, like, very dodgy sort of areas. But what I was interested in is just, I guess, like, I've put on heaps of weight over the last 4 or 5 years, and, like, I'm just quite interested in the way, like, I could probably move things better now, and I would probably hold myself better in a fight now, and that kind of thing. But, like, what the world tells me is that my worth is lower, and therefore I was just really interested in that idea of, you know, you can make people believe something. And I also was thinking a lot about collective action as well. Like, I was just thinking, you know, like, there are more of us that are not, you know, we literally call it the 1%, but somehow we're kept at bay. And this is why I was really interested, like, in that quote where I talk about manners and laws and stuff. Like, you know, like, laws are so fluid. Like, there's this amazing book called Golden Gulag. It's really good. It's about the industrial prison system in the west coast of the United States. And this idea that law is what we're deciding to enforce at any one time, you know. And, yeah, I was just really interested. You know, like, I remember thinking it one day when I was driving around. I was like, why did I stop at that red light? You know, like, it's not because I don't want to get a ticket. It's because I don't want to smash into somebody. And, yeah, I just think there's all these, systems of control that are not about, you know, there's power lying in all these places which are not necessarily the most innately powerful places. So, yeah, like, yeah, that's what I was thinking about.
Okay, because one other thing I really wanted to ask you about, which is, it's kind of a disciplinary tactic. People ask the giants, what would you know? And they also say, it would be better if you did this. And when I was reading that, I was like, first I was like, it's a really interesting disciplinary tactic, and I can kind of see how it relates to the world. But I was also thinking, what does Pip think about knowledge? Like, I wanted to ask you, like, do you think anybody knows? Do you think you know? Do you think, might I know? Or does nobody know? Like, should we all be saying, what do you know, to each other? Or should we never say it to anyone because it's kind of a horrible crime to say that to somebody? I don't know.
Yeah, I think, like, all those phrases, they're called, I think they're called self-terminating phrases. No, they're called conversation terminating phrases. So there's a really great book which is called Cultish, which came out while I was writing this. And instead of sort of looking at cults, it was looking at the linguistic nature of the language that's used in cults and the way that it's also used in Peloton, and it's also used in advertising, and it's sort of all around us, this idea of, you know, stopping. That's what they're called. They're called thought terminating phrases. So they just stop you from investigating. I don't know where to start with knowledge. I feel like there's been a capture of knowledge and then a control of knowledge, and, you know, we value some knowledges, not when I say we, I don't know who I mean when I say we, but society kind of values some knowledges higher than other knowledges, and it just all seems ridiculous. And yeah, like this, I don't know, like I saw Rachel O'Neill speak at the launch of their book, and they told this lovely story about someone saying to them, "You're the only person who knows what you want." And I just think how untrue that is for me, having grown up in this society. Do you know what I mean? Like, I really do not know what I want. And I think, yeah, so I just, and I think a lot of that has come from growing up in the systems that tell you what you need. Like, it's been really, what's the word I'm looking for? I found it really, really confronting with what's going on up at university. You know, like, that, you know, I shouldn't get into it, but just, you know, like, I want there to be a university, and I know that these cuts are not going to make it the type of university that I want. But also, I think there's some really interesting opportunities there. And I think that's the reason in the end that I feel so sad about the cuts, is that it's not a cut to make something new. It's not a re-strategizing. It's not a recreation. It's kind of, yeah, it's going to make it worse, because the people that are going to lose their jobs are the people probably that would be able to make a change. So, but also it's very interesting to live in a time where we're watching the destruction of the tertiary, you know, sector. Like, it's a very strange thing for me, you know. Like, I left school when I was 15 and worked as a hairdresser for 10 years and then went back to university as an adult student. And like I'm the first person in our family to go to university. And yeah, so I think, sorry, I can't separate knowledge from the institutions that hold it. But yeah, sorry, that was a muddle.
I'm going to answer you with another muddle. This relates to what you just said, I promise. In the back of the book, you said, you know, we should get rid of prisons, it's not working. And you said, to your mind, a fundamental part of that would be the return of stolen lands. This just came to my mind when you're talking about something new, because I think the return of stolen whenua on like a massive level would be something new. And I was just, I don't know, I'm interested in how that could relate to your novel. I'm interested in, because I think there are explicit relationships between prisons and your novel, and I just sense all these implicit ones that I'm not quite grasping. Can I give you back the mic now and you can talk to some of those things?
Again, this is one of the things that I feel really uncomfortable about the book, and I'm not sure. Like, I think, you know, that's part of writing a book, is that it starts a conversation, and sometimes people need to say things wrong and be challenged on them for them to be corrected. And the thing is that I knew that I wanted these people to go to a different planet, right? Because I wanted to get rid of all the structures that are already here on Earth. So that was exciting to me. But the minute you start talking about first contact novel, you're talking about colonization. Like, you're talking about, you know, arriving on someone else's land, and, you know, so I guess what I was about there was, my interest was in, I've got to be so careful how I say it, I'm not really impressed with myself, but like, sort of what it is to be a good colonizer, or a good, you know, what it is to go somewhere and have the lightest touch on the land and the culture. And I guess that's when I envisaged a planet that could, and a people, or you know, who could look after themselves in a way. I'm going to get myself in a muddle, but I do think fundamental to everything you know, this is the thing that I find so fucking hard. Like, when I hear them talking about new laws for ram raiding, you know, new correctional facilities, more youth correctional facilities, is that we walk every day on this massive crime, like this massive crime, like this wholesale, yeah, this wholesale theft. And then there's other crimes that are kind of impacted on top of that, yet we keep papering over it with this idea that, oh, we just need more youth facilities, or, you know, like, and, you know, like, yeah. So I just think that fundamental in it needs to be this readjustment, you know, this, yeah, this readjustment, this redistribution. Oh, is that what I'm talking about? Maybe that's what I'm talking about. But, you know, like, and just, yeah, like, I just think that it's really important to know if we are a visitor like me, you know, like my granddad came here from Mexico, my grandmother, you know, is Romani and her dad is Scottish as well. And, you know, we came from other places, and I think it's really important for me to know whose land I'm on. Like, and yeah, so yeah. And like I say, like, I'm so early in that trip that, yeah, it was probably a bit arrogant to write a book about it. But yeah, I don't know, like, I've been really grateful for the challenges that I've had already. Like, people have already, you know, challenged me on some of the things, and I feel really grateful for that. Like, I'm never a person that doesn't, I don't mind being told when I'm wrong. Like, I quite like it. But yeah, that means I don't go out trying to be wrong. But, you know, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons it's hard to talk about this part of the book is that we're really trying not to do any spoilers. I want to say that towards the end, for me, the book became kind of like pure possibility, or like condensed possibility in a condensed form, which is really interesting as a reading experience, because then how to convert that possibility to real life becomes a question for every person, which is, yeah, it's kind of like a challenge as well as a offering. Yeah, I think I forgot to time how long we were talking. I think we should put, does anyone in the audience want to ask a question? No? You guys can think and we can come back to you. I've got like loads of questions. Okay, if anyone thinks of a question, just stick your hand up and I can run over to you. Bear with me. Oh my god, yeah, Pip, what is the event horizon? What is the event horizon? Can you explain it on the spot?
Oh, the event horizon. Oh, yeah. The event horizon. Yeah. So while I was reading the book, they got the first ever photo of the event horizon of a black hole came out, and it was just one of the most beautiful things I'd ever seen. The other thing that happened when I was writing the book is the first sound recordings from Mars came out, which was just, oh my god, it was just so magnificent. So what was interesting about the event horizon for me was just the idea that it seems to consume everything. I also really like that movie, which is called Interstellar, I think. You know, like, just this, I don't know, like, I just do feel like there's something amazing about black holes, and that they do seem to hold all this possibility, like everything and nothing, and just all this very counterintuitive kind of physics. And, you know, and I think I just really would love to go through a black hole. Like, it's kind of one of my dreams. Like, sometimes when I can't sleep, I just think about how magnificent it would be. Not in a, I guess possibly in a death wish way, I don't know, but like, just this idea that if you had to go, it'd be a, well, you have to go, but like, if you had to go, it'd be a pretty fucking cool way to go. Like, just, I don't know, like, I just love this idea that, and again, it's one of those things that we hold in our head. Like, we walk around thinking, oh, I'm standing upright. You know, the earth feels kind of flat. And, you know, like, I don't know, there's all this really weird physics stuff. And yeah, and that thing, thank you so much for saying that thing about possibility at the end. Because I was just thinking, like, so much of that part of the book is me watching Bo play Minecraft. Like, it's, you know, and watching Bo play Minecraft and watching, you know, Zelda, that is Breath of the Wild. Yeah, Breath of the Wild. And, like, just all, like, our house is not very big. It's perfect for us. I'm very grateful for it. But all the video games need to be played in the lounge where I'm reading. And often I'll just stop reading and watch the video games. But, yeah, just this idea. In the early versions, Brent will probably put me right here, because I played Minecraft once and I dug in the ground and I just went straight down and I couldn't get out again. So I stopped playing Minecraft very quickly. I feel like in the early versions, the biome would make itself up as you walked into it. Yeah, so like, because it's a sandbox game, like, you can walk beyond your boundaries, but the boundaries will make themselves up as you walk into them. And that idea just, I just loved this idea that there was this world that was being made up as you walked into it, like, based on, you know, your fitness points. Don't think they're called fitness points. I'm really hopeless. But anyway, that's what I was thinking. Thank you.
I just have one more question, which is kind of an important question in my mind, and then we'll see if anyone else has any questions, and then maybe we'll go back to drinking tea. So this is a big question, and I'm trying to think how to... your book is, I think I'm right, hopefully other readers feel the same way, I think it's written in quite simple language, and I was, when I hear you talk, I feel like I can hear you making big ideas from little parts, almost, and when you say Minecraft, I feel like I can see you making like a really complicated structure, like with Lego. I'm not computer literate. Yeah, what does it mean for you to write that way? Do you do it on purpose? I wonder if you ever write, like, with really huge, complicated words and then change it, or, like, yeah, what's that about? How does it work? What does it mean?
That's a really good question. I did not go to school for very long. So, yeah, there's that. You know, and, like, I was not paying much attention for a long time at high school. Like, I think largely because I didn't understand a lot of what was going on. And then for some reason I decided to go to university. I have no idea why that happened. I think it was because I really liked reading books. Like, I read, the first adult book I read was Emma, and I read it when I was about 21 or 22, and like, I was like, wow, that bit where you suddenly realize that he likes her rather than, I was like, whoa, that's so cool. But yeah, so then I went to university and very quickly realized I was out of my depth. They kept talking about someone called Nietzsche, and then I kept seeing this other word written down in our textbooks. And I was like, who's this Nietzsche guy? Like, and where is Nietzsche? Why are we not? And I was just constantly confused like that. And also, I think, I think that also, like, that's kind of me being, I think I'm being arrogant saying those things, because I do love very complicated theoretical work. Like, I really love post-structuralism, I love postmodernism, I love writing, you know, weird writing about psychoanalysis, you know, like, I like all that sort of stuff, but I feel like what's really hard to do is make something complex out of simple language, you know, like, there's nowhere to hide. Like, I know that I've put on, you know, like, I've often used big words that I don't know, like, but then what I really like is, this is what I think has been quite interesting of the sort of re-embrace of kind of Judith Butler and stuff like that. I think sometimes there are words that have to be used in complicated ways to, you know, like, say, do you know what I mean? Like, to say the things. But it is, I think what it comes down to a lot is just that memory of being, like, I tried to read Maggie Nelson has a book about cruelty in art, and I tried to read it and I was so fucking confused, and like I just like I read the same three sentences four times and I was like googling words and yeah, and I don't know, I mean I really want to read that book but I'm gonna have to get someone to help me. But yeah, I think that's where it comes from, is just I just know, I'm interested in simple words. Like, what is it, you know, can you tell something complicated in simple words? I don't know. Oh, sorry, I've blacked out there.
Like yeah.
Checking out philosophy.
Okay. I just have this experience of, like, reading your book and then going back to my life and being like, oh, it's a bit different. And I will often think in quite big words and quite poetic ways, and you know, there's a lot going on up here, naturally. And then sometimes I'm like, Emily, what do you mean?
Yeah.
And I had that feeling so much after reading your book, like, what does this mean? What do I mean? What does she mean? What is that? Yeah. Yeah, which I really thank you for.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Julia, does anyone want to ask a question? No, no pressure. Either way. Anyone? Yeah? Okay. I'll bring you the mic. Here we go.
Thank you. Okay, I'll start off with a comment.
Yes.
And that's awesome. I love you.
Oh, I love you too. Yeah. Thank you.
Also, I really admire in your work that you go to the weird places, that your work is so surreal, and thinking what you were saying before, and I'm going to be a bit of a writer wank here, about highlighting things that we should think about by making it strange. Is that sort of a Brechtian thing that you're doing? Do you want, is that what you're wanting from your art for us to go, oh, we need to look at that?
Oh,
because
God.
If you think about your books, the weird things happen to the places that we should be paying attention to.
Oh my God.
Is that a question? That was a comment.
I like it. I like it. Oh my gosh. Oh, okay.
Sorry, that was hard.
No, I like it. I like the reason I'm going is because I, okay. About 3 months ago, we have this thing at work that when the radio goes off, we have a silence detector, and the silence detector kicks in this iPod of, you know, very random music. And Mac the Knife came on, and it was the version where, who was it? And that's exactly the one. Yes. Yes. Yeah. So there's this wonderful rendition, and like that, because of the screwing up of the words, like she was kind of like, oh, I don't know the next verse. And yeah, all of a sudden I listened in a completely different way. And that song is revolutionary. Like the lyrics, I don't know who did the translation, but this idea of violence, the way that it talks about violence is just absolutely incredible. And I became quite obsessed with Brecht, but I've never studied Brecht. So like I feel I'm very interested. Like I can see why it's sort of just crack cocaine waiting for me in that way, that it's like looking at, is it a crime to steal a loaf of bread kind of stuff. But I'm really confused about where to start with him. And yeah, so we can have a coffee and you can tell me where. But yeah, and I think that's one of the things, I never know how to say this, I never say it properly, but this idea that it's really hard to write realism, which is a kind of fantasy in itself, like it's a fantasy genre, and to write realism and then try and move to a different system, simply because the systems sort of are innate in the work, you know, like the you want to be a simulacrum. Hey, I'm using all the big words now, but you want to be a copy of the outside world, so you've got to have all the systems in place, so it's very hard to escape it. So that's what I think is happening there, is I'm thinking, oh, if I make this unusual, weird, surreal, different, magical, then all the power structures just disappear, you know, which is, again, you know, why I'm kind of, yeah, like, I think that is a lot what it's about. And so I guess that's, like, I'm interested in ways of, like, I just want to put in an absolute boost To Encode by T. Hema Baker is just one of the most incredible books, and I highly recommend it. And it does that sort of, like, it's kind of like, I was reading that this morning thinking that's what I really wish I could do. Like, I really wish I could do that, where the whole system, our system is being scrutinized, but in this, you know, like in 10,000 years from now, and like with alien invasion, and yeah, it's just incredible. That was a babbly answer, sorry. Oh, yes. I like the mic. I like we're all sharing the mic.
What you were saying about pure realism being a type of fantasy that's fantastic and all that. And I guess I wondered what it was about, if you're trying to tell a story that's not within the kind of realism fantasy, what was it specifically about, like, space influencing that appealed to you? Well, you kind of did talk about Event Horizons being cool, which is a valid thing there, but yeah, I was curious about what it was about space.
I really, the thing was sort of leaving this planet, if you know what I mean, like this, this idea that the physics of this planet could change us, you know, like this idea that there was a possibility to imagine a sort of non-carbon-based life form and, you know, that kind of thing. And plus, I do feel a little, what's the word I'm looking for? One of the doubts that I have about the book and had about the book while I was writing it is that there does seem to be this very strange, not strange, but there seems, since COVID and before, there seems to be this land grab by literary fiction of science fiction, and I find it very uncomfortable. Like, it sort of feels like there's a great, I don't know if it's an essay, but there's this great thing that Ursula Le Guin wrote after seeing Star Wars, you know, like a whole bunch of them went to see it, and they were like, for fuck's sake, you know, like, we've been doing this for years, and now some guy just, you know, puts together this very bad science fiction film, and everybody's like, yay, and... Yeah, so I guess, like, I am, and I was really grateful for a lot of people in science fiction writing communities when I was writing this, like, especially Darusha Wayne. Like, I remember saying to them one night, oh my God, I've never written a spacecraft. And they said to me, yeah, no one's written the spacecraft for their novel yet. You know, like, everybody's always writing their first spacecraft because they're always writing new novels. And they were just very kind to me about, yeah, like, this is the thing is that I think... It looks like there's a... They were just very helpful with that sort of stuff. And I think... But it was something I was very aware of while I was writing. It was kind of like, ah, oh, you know, like... Yeah, so... But I do love space. Like, and I think that was the other thing. You know, someone like Samuel Delaney or someone like that where, you know, you can see that this whole... Especially Samuel Delaney's kind of... sort of like this ability to reinvent gender, reinvent queerness, escape all those things from some of the things that we do here. I don't know, like, I just, the possibilities are huge. And also, like, I'm very confused by fantasy was another thing. Like, I get very confused by fantasy, like, I drive Brent crazy because I'm just like, what time is this happening? What planet is this happening on? Where did they get the fabric for their clothes? What is going? Is there a factory nearby? And yeah, so I think fantasy is safe from my, like, terribleness. But yeah.
Anyone else want to volunteer a question? No? Okay, we'll go back to tea and chips.
What's that?
We'll go back to tea and chips.
Tea and chips is good. Yeah, I like tea and chips.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everyone. Cheers.
Thank you so much for your time. Yay. 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 Yay.